You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
Ken Vellante, want to thank you for joining Something Rather Than Nothing. A quick note about a couple upcoming episodes. Very excited to have Matt Petre, a musician based in Providence, Rhode Island, with his new album, Six Syllables. And also coming up, really excited about this one, Blair Bathory of Fear House, creating horror content and a lot of cool, exciting short film. Blair Bathory of Fear House coming up soon. In this episode, chat with Mishka Shibali and Super Conversation. Start off this episode where I congratulate Mishka on the day of recording on his 11th year of sobriety from alcohol. A great accomplishment, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
Thanks, man. I had no conception that, you know, when I got sober that, like, oh, okay, I'll be sober for 11 years. But, you know, it's you just sort of try and put as many good days together as you can. And I feel like the word weird is something that we just sort of apply to everything. So it has absolutely no meaning at this point. But yeah, it's weird to be sober for 11 years.
I'd imagine. I have 9/9/2009 sobriety date. So one of the, you know, whatever keeps you sober, one of the strange gifts, weird gifts that I've had is not wanting to get rid of that date because it's too cool of a date. So
whatever it takes, man, to build that barricade, to shore that barricade up, to you know, and I think, you know, not wanting to lose a good visually pretty number like that is as good a reason as any to stay sober, man. Like, it's like really whatever works.
I completely agree with you. And we'll get into that and talking a bit about, sobriety and some of your writing. But before we get into some of that stuff, just wanted to ask you, what were you like as a young child? Were you always entertaining, doing things? What were you like?
I was both shy and I wanted to be the center of attention. I think as, you know, a lot of kids are, I remember being very young and I like, you know, getting to, you know, to like, a family friend's house. And the first thing that I wanted to do was like, eat a couple brownies and like take my shirt off and run around the house screaming. So not much has changed. But I remember too, like, you know, people are always doing these sort of like quizzes and stuff like that on Facebook of like, oh, what was the first artist you saw? And like, you know, who woke you up to, you know, to art or music or whatever. And I remember my, you know, my parents sort of like just took us kids with them everywhere they went. And I remember probably being like, you know, six, and we went to dinner somewhere. And then after dinner, there was this dude in a wheelchair who got up with his guitar and sang and played songs and told jokes and dirty stories in between the songs. And I was just like, man, that is it. That's what I'm going to do right there. Mom, get me a wheelchair immediately. You know, I need to be this guy. And, I have no idea who he is or who he was, but just sort of like a local songwriter type. That really sort of changed things for me. That really opened it up for me.
Yeah. And I know, just as far as seeing and listening to the material you produced and having followed you, there's a huge component of storytelling in what you do. So it seems like that's kind of like a fundamental component of what you do, to kind of pull people into the stories with songs or with your writing. Regarding art, and obviously that was an influential experience for you. What type of art do you enjoy, or did you start to develop enjoying, like you start listening to a lot of music, a particular type, and got really into that, or authors? So what do you partake in as far as art?
I think early on, I sort of decided that I was going to be a nihilist, being like 9 or 10 and discovering Guns N' Roses. I was like, this is it. Parents are just full of shit. And the world is stupid. And, the only thing that matters is girls and guitar and getting fucked up, there's still, we are very much now the people that we are when we were children, with some few differences there. And so I carry that. It's like, that seed of nihilism fell in my heart at a very young age and put down deep roots, And so it is difficult for me sometimes to get out of that and not just to be like, oh, the art that I like is, Married with Children or the Ramones or something, the sort of the crassest, most lowbrow stuff possible. But I was always fortunate to have smart, fucked up, crazy friends. And a friend of mine, Ben Bertocci, went on to become a fine artist and actually runs Jeff Koons' art studio now in New York.
Oh, wow.
And through my connection with Ben and my friendship with him, that's been a sort of a great, conduit for me into art, because, Ben is an effective sort of portal into that world where I remember listening to Gwar and Megadeth and driving around with Ben, drinking beer when we were kids. So when he's in a gallery, there's less resistance there, to go and look at his stuff. And I feel like I have a window into understanding his work through my personal connection to him. And then because I'm friends with him and because I can talk to him about his work and sort of be involved in his work or have a direct dialogue with him about it, art seems less scary or less bougie, less off-putting, as it might be otherwise.
I definitely pick up on that. And I, in talking about, you as a writer, I've listened to the Long Run and recently on Audible, Cold Turkey, which, I love that work, and I'm going to be real here, Mishka, and just lay it out. I really like how you interrogated really important questions. You laid stuff out there, you laid up, expose yourself. This is fucked up. Here's how I got sober, And I know from what you were saying in the book, it's like, here's these crazy ass experiences. And I did this drink and I was extreme in this type of stuff, but I stopped drinking. And, for me, I look at that type of thing, as, whatever works. We're just talking about that, me getting hung up on the 999 sobriety date for me, good enough. And whatever the program was, AA and outpatient rehab got me sober. But what you do in Cold Turkey, you're talking about your experiences and you're talking about, this is how I did this. This seems like bullshit to me. This worked for me. This didn't work for me. And this worked for others and this didn't work for others. And it's a brave stance and definitely controversial, because we're talking about, a rehabilitation or a community where, say, for alcohol, AA is, the program. So what was your experience in laying out cold turkey and saying, hey, look, this is how I did it. These are the, some of the things that I put in place and, you know, give it a shot. What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, I should sort of back up before, before answering that question and, you know, say that this isn't a project that I wanted to do. This is very much a project that I didn't want to do. And Audible approached me about it at a time when I was broke. And I was like, yeah, fuck it. I'll do it. I need the money. And thank God they did. Because once I got it, you know, once I engaged the project and once I like really got into it, I found that I had a lot to say about it. And that it was deeply meaningful to me and that I cared a tremendous amount, you know, so I perhaps went into the venture with bad or cynical reasons. But then once I was there, I was like, you know, it's like you can make a decision out of bad faith, but then you can carry through that decision in good faith, you know? I committed to do this thing. I need to do the best damn job that I can. And I fucking hate self-help and I hate charlatans and snake oil salesmen and pretenders who are like, oh yeah, sign up for, you know, to, you know, for my book and my DVD for $39.95. And then the recurring monthly charge for $9.95 for my seminar. And then you get the tote bag. It's like, fuck all that shit. It's like this profiteering, you know? And it's like, I mean, it's one of the things we see, find that's so despicable right now with the coronavirus that, you know, the price gouging, and, you know, we find it so repellent when individuals do that, but that's exactly what the pharmaceutical industry does. They find a need and then they exploit it as much as they can get away with, you know? And so it was really important to me to provide the greatest amount of information that I could, to be 100% honest about my experience and what my level of authority is and isn't. And then to just try to give people value for their dollar, man, you know, and that was, you know, a big reason why I'm so grateful to Audible, you know, for making the book free for this month. Because, you know, I said point blank in the book, you know, I don't want this to be you know, the best business is repeat business. I don't want your repeat business. I want you to listen to this book. I want you to be able to use the tools that I lay out there for you. And then I want you to never need me again. You know, right. There's no guarantee. Addiction is incredibly, you know, it's like trying to clean up an oil stain in a puddle. You know, I mean, it takes a lot of work. It's incredibly slippery. But I just tried really hard to tell people to download all the information that I had about addiction, about alcoholism, about getting sober on your own, about recovery. I did give a rigorous interrogation of AA and 12-step and that, you know, that culture. I think that, you know, the best way you can, you know, I was thinking about this when I was running today, you know, I need my body. I rely on my body. I'm 43, so I don't think I can honestly say that I love my body, but I count on it. I need my body to do shit for me. And because I need my body to do shit for me, I work it hard. I test its limits. You know, can I do 5 more pushups? Can I do 2 more pushups? Can I do 1 more? Can I, all right, I'm going to run to the stoplight. You know, you have to push the limits so that, you know, to keep it as fit as possible. And that's the same thing you need to do with democracy. It's the same thing you need to do with art, same thing you need to do with music, the same thing you need to do with recovery, right? You need to rigorously test the strength of the system, make sure that it's still working. And it needs to, you know, it's like your computer, you have to install the updates. You have to upgrade it, you know?
Sure. And
I feel like, you know, not to attack anyone who's had success in AA or any 12-step program, because if it works, it works, man. And if AA has worked for you, then you don't need me at all. But I do think that there's not one solution that works for everybody. So I just wanted to add another voice to, you know, if AA didn't work for you, or if you have a ton of resistance towards AA, then here's another way.
Yeah. Here's another direction. I like what you had to say there, and some deep wisdom, and kind of like stretching systems and stretching, you know, what we're doing to see if the damn things work. And I like that dynamic, because it demands a lot, you know, on yourself, but on what's around you. My and you mentioned running. My brother's a runner, and I've known a lot of runners in my life. Now, I haven't been a runner. I've been getting fitter and fitter the best I can. Long walks, I check with my brother for you know, kind of advice around diet and kind of keeping things up. But there's something about runners I really trust, and I really think that they have some deep intellectual insight, even though, you know, you think about it, that they're just running. What's running done for you?
I was thinking about this the other day too, and I don't know if this is in response to the question or if it's just an interesting.
No, that's fine. Whatever.
But I feel like running is like the opposite of sex, because when you're having sex, you're intently focused on the one thing, right? You're, sure. You know, you're just totally in the moment, obsessed with that thing. When you're running, your body is occupied physically. So if you're somebody who's always obsessed with working and being efficient and being productive, like I am, then you can sort of pat yourself on the head and be, you know, I'm being a good boy. I'm doing work. I'm doing a thing. But while you're running, your brain is free to wander. And so it's, you know, it's almost, you know, if you go out running by yourself and you run for 2 or 3 or 4 hours or whatever, you don't have an iPod or an iPhone or whatever with you. It's like a forced meditation. Can you imagine, like, just sitting there in a chair with no music, just sitting there with your eyes closed and just thinking for 3 hours? Like, that would never happen, you know?
Right,
and
right.
If I knew someone who did shit like that, I would be like, do I need to check in on you, man? Like, are you okay? You know, but, you know, so a lot of times, you know, I running always, for me, it's paired with writing, because you write to, you get to a point where you're stuck. And then you're like, fuck, I can't go any further. I'm going to go for a run. But you're holding in your head the problem, you know, like, you know, she wants to walk through the green door, but I need to get her to walk through the pink door. But how do I get her to walk through the pink door?
Right, no. Right.
And then, so if you go out for a 15-mile run with that in your head, then for the next 3 hours, that's the only thing you're going to think about. So you'll fucking figure it out, because you have to, you know, you're turning it over and over in your head, you know. And, you know, similarly, you know, with recovery, you know, I will, you know, I'll go running, you know, running about something that I'm angry about, or, you know, or that I'm grieving about, you know, if I get into a fight with my sister, she's pissing me off. Man, fuck her. She's fucking always like this, you know? And then you go out for a run and then you're like, oh, well, I mean, I remember when seventh grade when, oh man, I was so horrible to her in seventh grade, you know? And then, so you have an opportunity to spend sustained time with your emotions. But it's not like you're in a room doing therapy or something like that. So you don't have your hackles up. You know, what you're doing is running. But there's the other thing that happens, which all the shit that happens with your brain. It's like, you know, you go to sleep and you lay down and you rest, and that's your primary job. But your secondary job is dreaming, you know? So it is like this, you know, this waking dream, you know, friend of mine died last week, the ultra runner Dave Clark, and like fucking heartbroken about it. We all are. You know, he was an incredible guy, and you know, I've just been running through my grief. You know, just take sunglasses so people can't see that you're crying. You know, or go early enough or late enough. There's not a lot of people out on the street, and just, and then just carry him with you and just sort through that. You know.
Yeah, I'm sorry for your loss, and I know, you know, I definitely understand. Running through that, you have an idea and a kind of a meditation or an ability to think. When you're running, and you know, and during these times, I was wondering, Mishka, just about, you know, you're obviously an intelligent guy. You think a lot. You know, you run, you write, you're an entertainer, you create. What's it been like doing your stuff, doing your creative stuff in a pandemic?
Actually, you know what? Let me tag one more answer onto your last
question. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
One of the things I want to say, too, that I need to say about running is that since I was a child, I never understood theism. You know, that I remember being like six and walking out onto the driveway, and I was wearing my little green running shorts, and, you know, and I think I had my skateboard. And I looked up at the sky, and I was like, nah, there's nothing up there. You know, and I could never understand why people were so attached to this concept of there being a God or there being a, you know, a greater wisdom or intelligence or, you know, design up there. Sure. And I always struggled too with, you know, I have a lot of friends in AA, some of my greatest friends. And, you know, they're always sort of like trying to get me to understand the concept of higher power, you know, and it's just, you know, it's something bigger than you. And I was like, oh, running, you know, and then the more that I explored my relationship with running, I was finally able to sort of understand theism and the appeal of that, you know, for me to be able to think, you know, running is all around me. It surrounds me. And whenever I need it, I can just go out and have a direct line of communication with running. And when I need running, I can take as much as I want. There's running is limitless. There's no amount of running that I can take from the whole that will diminish it. It will always be greater than me, and it will always be surrounding me, even if I'm not currently running at the time, you know? So it's on a larger sort of cosmic level, running, my relationship with running was able to sort of help me parse other folks' relationship with God or gods or spirituality or, you know, anything like that.
And thanks for bringing that in. I hadn't heard that perspective or don't recall that. And, I think you're right. I think within the higher power question within life, you know, but certainly within AA or that which is bigger than you or that higher power, I think it can be tremendously helpful, for whatever reason you're looking at it and for you to find that great activity of running where you're connecting, of understanding. I call that like the sublime, where something's just bigger than you. You're kind of in like awe and reverence of how big it is.
Right.
And I've always tried to figure out a way of understanding the higher power, understanding what people feel when they go to church. And for me, I have such an emotional connection to beautiful art, particularly paintings. And when I'm in a discussion with a believer, I try to express that is what I believe spirituality is for me. I'm experiencing the sublime. It's impacting me. It's bigger than me. It makes me feel good. It makes me wonder. And, you know, I think people experience that in different ways. And, you know, for you, physically and mentally with running, I'm glad you brought that into it. And you felt that when you thought about that or had that experience a bit more, you were able to connect a little bit more with what folks were saying when they're saying AA, higher power, what that is, right?
Yeah. It was, I mean, it, it, ended up being, it was a real aha moment, you know, where it sort of, in that moment, I was able to build a bridge to the friends and strangers who had a hard time, you know, understanding where they were coming from or what their attachment was. You know, I mean, I still gripe with AA that the higher power quickly becomes God and quickly becomes a straight white patriarchal, you know, Christian God. Because now I'm fucking totally on board with this higher power shit, man. I think it's a great idea. You know, I love it, you know, and now that, you know, now that I was able to see it through running, I see it everywhere. You know, my sister's old dog, she had this chocolate lab who was, she was like fat and she smelled bad and she was just such a beautiful animal. And like, I could just, she would just be laying on the floor and I could just look over at her. And the minute that we made eye contact, she would smile at me and her tail would go back on the floor, you know? And if I looked away, like her tail would stop and she would sort of, you know, chill out. And then if I looked at her again, she would just smile at me with her eyes immediately and the tail would start going, you know? And it was just that connection between her and I, you know, and the connection between, you know, any person and any dog, you know, that's another higher power there too, you know? And so it was like, once I was able to see it in running, then I was able to see it everywhere and I love it. And like, man, that's got nothing to do with the Bible or church or hellfire and damnation and hating gay people. And I was like, come on, man, like right. Higher power rocks, you know?
I definitely know. And I think the word that you mentioned, connection there, I kind of got, every once in a while I get floored, you know, by, you know, hearing certain things. And I heard, when Russell Brand talk, and he was saying that the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, it's connection.
Right.
And I that's why I heard that word connection with you. And at first, like, it's kind of like dropped what I was holding. I'm like, whoa, because so many of us, you know, like in the pandemic, whether we're trying to communicate with people on video or, you know, you're calling up, we're doing a podcast on Skype or like however we're trying to connect, we're craving connection. And there's something profound, you know, in that.
I used to have this experience over and over again with friends in New York where they would be like, well, I've had it, man. I'm fucking moving to this place out in, you know, Arkansas or the Catskills or whatever. And, I'm done with New York. I'm done with people. I'm just going to build a cabin. I'm never coming back. And I would be like, all right. And they're like, well, you know, aren't we going to say goodbye? And I was like, nah, go have fun. You know, 3 months later, they'd be back and they'd be like, man, yeah, I couldn't fucking hack it, man. I'm like, yeah, no, this is the worst thing about being a human being is we need each other. You know,
yeah.
And that's one of the things that's so terrifying and so horrifying with the pandemic is that we need people. We need each other and not just the fucking pizza delivery guy. You know, we need all the different sort of contact and connection that we have with all the, you know, all the different people that we see, you know, during the course of our day. And also, we are the enemy. We are the disease, you know, it's not the Russians and it's not China and it's not invaders from Mars. It's the invisible boogeyman is, you know, a viral agent that's carried by other human beings. So the very
right.
thing that we need the most, the thing that makes us human, is also the thing that could make us incredibly sick or cause us to lose our lives or carry, you know, my greatest fear is, you know, getting it and not getting particularly sick and then giving it to my mom and then it killing her.
Right. You know, very, very, very real fears of the vulnerability. And I think, you know, what you said is really important. Hadn't quite thought about it in that way, just in the sense that, yeah, there isn't an external, you know, country or planet or, you know, some supernatural aspect to it. It's something that human beings are, you know, sharing
yeah
with each other. We're chatting with Mishka Shubali. And Mishka, I got a track here that I talked about. Wanted to introduce everybody, and they might already be familiar with your music. I love your music. I love the style. It's the I was trying to describe it to somebody, but I liked it's, you know, kind of like a raw existential storytelling. I really vibed with it. So what I wanted to do was to play a track, Destructible, play that now. And then when we get back, we'll chat a little bit about the, you know, the other iteration of yourself. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
All right.
Farmer John, you've got a lovely daughter. Green apple conditioner, like blood in the water. Chipping fingernail polish, second year of college. What secrets does she keep inside her heart-shaped locket? Tea so sweet, it hurts your teeth. Farmer John, I'm in love with your daughter. She lets the towel fall and steps into the water. Her slender body swinging like a pendulum. As close to the beginning as I am to the end. I am destructible. Glass half empty, resentful. Out of patience, out of time. Fire prone on bulletproof. I cannot tell the truth. Cut the shades down, pull the lights. The darkest hour is just before the middle of the night.
Song, Mishka.
I wish I didn't have to.
That's Destructible off the album When We Were Animals, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
funny, because it accidentally lined up, you know, perfectly with what we were talking about, you know, so I sort of took an inversion of, you know, Indestructible, and just said destructible, you know, to talk about human weakness.
Sure.
You know, and one of the things that I always say out of the gate to my writing students, you know, is that they all come in there and, you know, I just say, you know, look around, like, no, seriously, look at the other people in the room here with you. We've all shit our pants. We've all pissed the bed. We all carry a terrible secret where, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
this is, and let's not try to gloss over this. This is what makes us human beings. This is what makes us who we are. To keep it secret, to keep it private, is to grant it power. And what we're here for is to understand, you know, and it is by going into that stuff and is sharing. I guess it's sharing that weakness that we all have with each other is what makes us stronger.
Yeah, and I really vibe with what you're saying there. Is that the most difficult damn thing to do, though?
It is, but it, you know, it gets easier. In 2001, I was shipwrecked, and in the process of making out of that misadventure alive, I drank my own urine, and my friends fucking love that story, right? So like, haha, pee drinker, you know.
Sure,
and,
sure.
It does just, you know, it tickles the child inside each one of us. Like, haha, you drank your pee.
Sure, sure.
And you know, for a long time, I felt like, you know, weird about it and ashamed about it, obviously, you know. But then, you know, coming out with that story publicly and writing about it and publishing that story and telling that story, now I'm like, fuck yeah, I did that. In a bad situation, I'm the guy you want in the foxhole with you, because I will do what it takes to survive, you know? It's one of those things, you know, it's like being an alcoholic, you know, I mean, your first year of sobriety or 3 years or whatever, it's just such a weird, awkward, dirty word. I'm an alcoholic, you know?
Yeah.
You just feel like such a piece of shit. And now I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. You know, even with that, I've managed to do this. And from being an alcoholic and from the time that I've spent fucking having to work long hours when I was hungover, or having to scramble to find a new job when I got fired from the last one, or, you know, finding different ways to eat, to survive, to keep moving forward. I have a very particular skill set from that now, you know. I'm like I was scared, and I am scared about this pandemic shit, but like, I shouldn't be, man, because I'm like half cockroach and half coyote. Like, I was born born and then trained for the end times, you know,
to survive. And you got enough stories, Mishka, that I think you just dropped that in there. And it wasn't a metaphor that you were shipwrecked. You were shipwrecked. What the hell happened?
Yeah, no, I was literally shipwrecked. Yeah, I was crewing on a sailboat with friends of the family in 2001 in July. And we ran aground on the uninhabited point of an island in the Bahamas in the middle of the night. And, you know, the next morning the captain said, well, there's a town 25 miles this way. I'm going to go and get help. And I surprised myself by being like, nah, I'm going to do that instead, and you're going to stay here with the boat. I no longer enjoy long walks on the beach. fucking sucked, man.
That'll do it. That was mission and survival based, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Wanted to ask you a question about, about your, just in general, about your creativity. Have you ever asked yourself why it is that you create songs, write books, create books? What, you ever ask yourself why you create?
No, I mean, I think I think I know now why I do. I think, you know, when I was, my mom was huge on the public library, you know, and we would go to the library twice a week, you know, when I was a kid, and we would go and, you know, check out as many books as we were allowed and go home and read them all. And, you know, I had a series of little reading lights and headlamps and stuff like that, you know, reading in the car on the way home from the library. And, so I was like telling, I understood narrative, and I was like telling stories, you know, from a very young age. And so, you know, initially I was, you know, I just make stuff because something pops into my head, you know, like, you know, there's an idea or there's a punchline, and then you have to like work your way backwards and find out, oh, what's the setup for that punchline or whatever. Last night I was like laying there on the couch, and the big thing on Twitter of like Karens, you know, like these privileged white women who are want to talk to a manager, and, you know.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So, and I came up with Karen Abdul-Jabbar, and I was like, that's not anything yet, but one day I will write a setup. It's like Jeopardy. You work, backwards from the answers. You know,
I was listening to Dave Chappelle. He did a Netflix special, and he talked about his fishbowl, that he writes the punchlines in the fishbowl, and then he works backwards from the fishbowl that's in his living room. One of the things I wanted to ask, and it's just what this was like. I had mentioned to you, you know, speaking about comedy, and I know you've opened up for Doug Stanhope, who's just a fantastic, wild comedian and thinker. What did you do to open up for Doug Stanhope?
He famously hates my jokes, hates my comedy, you know, just wants me to be a trained pony and get up there and play my songs and, you know, and then shut my mouth and get off stage, you know. But you can't put the genie back in the bottle, Doug. Sorry, buddy. I got the gig because the dude at my record label at the time, you know, was like, Stanhope, you know, tours playing rock clubs, and sometimes he brings musicians, you know, out to open up for him. If I can get you that gig, you know, will you do it? I was like, yeah, I mean, of course I'll do it, you know, but like, it's never going to happen. You know, I mean, how would that ever happen? It's not going to happen. And then he fucking stalked Stanhope until Stanhope was finally like, okay, like he had gotten Doug's phone number somehow, and he had Doug on the phone, and Doug was like, okay, I'm here. I have the CD in front of me right now. As soon as I hang up the phone with you, I'm going to listen to the CD, and then you're never going to call me ever again. And my friend was like, okay, I get it. That's fine. And then like 20 minutes later, his phone rang, and it was Doug. And Doug was like, hey, what's Mishka's phone number? And then he called me, brought me out on tour with him, man, and changed my fucking life, you know?
So it might be... perfect setup guy, perfect fall guy. I'm not sure which one.
Yeah, I definitely felt like I was, you know, his whipping boy at times that they're out on the road. But, you know, I mean, I think it came from a very genuine place for him, you know, that like when we experience something, it's like, oh man, you got to try this, you know, or you got to hear this band, or you got to see this movie, or you got to read this book, or you got to see this painting, or, you know, we take so much of our enjoyment, in this world by proxy, you know. I remember doing a tour with a couple of bandmates who hadn't driven through the country an endless number of times, and driving through New Mexico, they were like, what the fuck is this place? And I was like, oh yeah, New Mexico is so weird, man. I fucking love this place, you know, but had I been driving through by myself, I wouldn't have remembered that New Mexico
sure.
was cool.
Sure. Sure. And you played you played music, right? I mean, you played your songs, and did you try to tell a couple jokes or?
Well, that's the thing is, like, when I was first doing stuff with Stanhope, I was mostly just playing the songs, and then I'd have a little one liner or something like that in between the songs, you know, for going from one to the next. And but then getting Stanhope's blessing, you know, he's such a cult figure, and he cut such a large shadow on underground comedy that then, you know, then he was like playing my music on his podcast, and that won me, a whole new crowd and a much larger crowd. And then those people would invite me to come and perform on their comedy shows. And then, you know, I was performing with a bunch of sort of like open micers. And I remember like seeing them and hearing their jokes and thinking like, man, I'm funnier than this, you know? And for the longest part, it was just nonfiction. It was just funny or embarrassing stories from my life. And then, one time I wrote a joke, and then at a show, I was like, all right, fuck it. I'm just going to do this joke. And I did the joke, and it fucking killed. And I was like, oh shit, you know, I guess now I'm doing that. And then, yeah, it's a slippery slope, man. Be careful. You could wind up a comedian too.
Hey, and thanks for, I mean, you know, thanks for all your writing, all your work, the jokes, the music, just incredible stuff. I got one more question for you, and then I kind of want to open up and just kind of let you know folks, you know, tell folks how to connect to all your great stuff. But the big question is, why is there something rather than nothing?
I think there is something because there is nothing. I don't think there's any, I don't think there's any order to this world. I think the only order that we see is the order that we impose on the world. And so I don't think that, I don't think the world in itself has any intrinsic meaning. I think we're just sort of like born onto this ball hurtling through space, to live and eat and fuck and die. And, it doesn't mean anything. There's nothing inherently meaningful to it. However, we have brains that are too big and too small. You know, we have brains that are large enough to record every trauma that's ever happened to us, but brains that aren't big enough to figure out how to release that shit. You sort of carry it with you. And so we find ourselves compelled to see meaning or to see an order. And 43 years old, the only way that I've found to make sense of this fucking senseless world is to love people, to love dogs, to love cats, to love old guitars, to connect with people, you know, to make a joke with the person making your coffee or whatever, or the person you're making coffee for, you know, try and get people to laugh, try and have that, you know, there be some kind of connection, and to make stuff, to make something, you know, I mean, I think the only response to nothing is something, you know, when you're given a blank chalkboard or a blank canvas or, you know, a hole in the ground, you got to put something in it. You got to put something on it. You have to, you know, even now, if I'm walking by, you know, freshly poured concrete, I'm going to stop and write something in it, you know, maybe not my initials, you know, but we have that, you know,
that spirit.
Yeah. So I think we're just trying to, make sense of it. We're trying to make it mean something. And if we try to make it mean something, it means everything, dude. It's so fucking meaningful.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Mishka. Mishka Shubali, how do folks find you? Obviously I've hinted, you know, you got your music, You got some stuff on Audible. I know there's some stuff on Amazon. Can you just lead listeners to come in contact with you and your works?
Well, I'm the only Mishka Shabali out there. So if you Google my name, you'll find me everywhere. I'm at Mishka Shabali on Twitter. I'm at Mishka Shabali on Instagram. I have like an official page on Facebook and a personal page. I'm on Spotify. If you search my name on Amazon, you'll find all my writing. My audiobooks are all on Audible.
And you're on Bandcamp too, right?
Yeah, I'm on Bandcamp. I'm on Spotify, Google Play. I have Venmo, Cash App. I have every single way of getting my music to you and every single way of accepting a tip or a t-shirt sale from a drunken patron in a bar.
That's
survival, man.
That's what you gotta do. Well, thanks for that, and I appreciate, I deeply appreciate that. You know, part of the reason I do the program and reach out to you, Mishka, is that, obviously about the sobriety, my own personal journey, but I really enjoy your honesty, talking about the human condition, and you know, writing, singing, telling those stories. Doing all these things that you do. I just want to let you know that work's important. And I think another component that I like about it is that it jostles me. And I'm always interested in thinkers and creators who jostle us in order to think fresh about it, question things. And you certainly do a lot of that. So I'm just honored that you've spent the time on the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. And I just want to let you know, I really appreciate you and your time.
Absolutely, man. My pleasure.
Thanks, Mishka. And you take care.
All right. Take care.